Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. The summer of 1986 was a wild time in Niagara Falls. Since the 1880s, tourists have flocked to the falls, and enterprising folks found new ways to capitalize on those visitors. And in 1986, it got ugly, according to an article from that year in the New York Times titled "Violent Battle for Tourists in Niagara." Are you ready for this? Not only were tourism companies painting over official signs to the falls, like that guy at the beginning of Bedknobs and Broomsticks painting over the signposts in case the Nazis drop in, but they were setting up fake tourist information booths to direct tourists where they wanted them to go. But then those fake information booths were getting straight up firebombed. That's right, rival tourism companies were tossing Molotov cocktails and detonating pipe bombs at each other's setups. One independent owner, whose stand was pipe bombed, worked summers in Niagara and the rest of the year as a teacher. He said, "I'm just a little guy. I think I got caught in a crossfire." A tour bus full of tourists at the time was pelted by rocks, smashing the windows, and one of the big player tour operators' homes was shot at repeatedly. But despite the gang warfare on the American side, people still came to Niagara. What was it that was attracting people to the falls? Was it the romance of the themed motels, the awesome power of nature, the numerous choices for entertainment and dining once you're done being awed by the power of nature? Or was it that you might witness some mind-numbing stunt by people who walked a thin line between bravery and insanity? The first stunt was in 1859, when a French performer who went by the name Blondin walked a tightrope across the 975-foot-wide Niagara Gorge just below the falls. And then the stunts got weirder and more extreme, with people strapping themselves into various contraptions, sometimes with their pets, one guy went over with a turtle, and sometimes with their lovers. And some of them didn't survive. But people still did it. In 1986, two college kids needed to be rescued while clinging to a rock feet from going over the falls when their homemade fiberglass barrel took on water almost immediately. And famed French stunt artist Philippe Petit, you know, the guy who tightrope walked between the Twin Towers, finally achieved his dream of recreating Blondin's stunt for a documentary about Niagara Falls stunt performers. He had applied for a permit to walk across the top of the falls in the 70s and was denied, so this was a big deal for him. A dream achieved, if you will. Dreaming big and pursuing. That's the lesson here. Blondin's antics also serve as a point of inspiration for the young protagonist in our first film, although both our movies today involve blind faith, stick-to-itiveness, and yes, just a little bit of shenanigans. But let's start with painful-looking stunts, baby Keanu Reeves, and tragedy compiled on tragedy in a Flashdance ripoff. Let's talk flying, a.k.a. Teenage Dream. Cam, do you want to kick us off?
Dream to Believe.
Yes, I was going to say.
Is the other title.
Don't get into the a.k.a. because there's a fourth one as well. Flying, yes. Flying is a gymnastics film from 1986. The real year where the gymnastics boom peaked in cinema. It is Canadian. A fun 80s confection. You may have thought and realized correctly that due to the many, many titles, this is a film which has fallen between the cracks of copyright and is available out there. It is not on Hollywood Suite because it cannot really be properly licensed.
Which we tried. We did try.
Yes,
and unfortunately,
we looked into it.
Mostly it's in horrible quality from where you can watch it.
The highest quality you can get it is VHS, essentially.
I do want to mention this is also a Hong Kong Golden Harvest co-pro,
what?
which is another layer of why the rights are going to be so messed up, added onto the layer of this is a fantastic soundtrack, and I can't even imagine they paid for the rights for this music.
Yeah. Golden Harvest, we should say, did a bunch of Jackie Chan's early stuff, a lot of Hong Kong action. Like, that's like the early, early years of that kind of cinema. And
they had a big presence in Canada in the 80s.
Yeah, and a lot of Montreal, Deadly Eyes.
Yeah, Deadly Eyes. More giant rat movies.
I think this is probably the first Golden Harvest gymnastic exploitation film. I don't know a lot about Golden Harvest, but I don't know of another Canadian co-pro they did for gymnastics.
Yes, definitely their first Canadian gymnastics, all of these. But yeah, I'll start off maybe before we get into the plot, just talking about gymnastics in the 1980s and why there is a brief kind of three-year gymnastics boom. It's a big time for gymnastics, which may be forgotten. And it's a big time for gymnastics kind of just because the sport of gymnastics was reaching new heights, no pun intended. You had in 1976, I believe, is when Kurt Thomas breaks a bunch of records for gymnastics. 1980, so it's also a weird time for the Olympics. It's tumultuous. 1980, the Olympics are in Moscow. All the Americans boycott it. 1984, they're in Los Angeles. It's very pro-American. All the Soviets boycott it. But throughout this, you've got Kurt Thomas, Nadia Comaneci, who becomes the first perfect 10 gymnast to get all 10s, and then Mitch Gaylord in 1984, who kind of leads the gymnastics team, who is kind of the America team, the team that everybody loved. This leads to most of these people getting films. Kurt Thomas is in Gymkata, the kind of classic gymnast turned karate man. Mitch Gaylord is in American Anthem this year in 1986. It's pretty much what you would expect from an American version of this movie, and they wisely make Mitch Gaylord like the third lead, but he's a very handsome young man, so if you see the cover of it, it's just him with his shirt off. And then of course you've got a non-gymnast John Stamos playing gymnast turned spy in Never Too Young to Die alongside Vanity, also in
Vanity. Oh, man, I can't wait till we get to a Vanity movie. I want to go down her rabbit hole so bad.
Never Too Young to Die, look it up. He fights Gene Simmons.
What? Oh man.
Yeah, I think Timothy Dalton is his father, maybe. Anyway, over in Canada, we have the Flying. Flying is the story of a young woman named Robin, who is new to town. She is kind of a quote-unquote mousy nerd, though you would never know from her being played by the beautiful Olivia Dabo. But she is somebody who helps out at the gym, but gets picked on a lot. And she is kind of in love with the hot gymnast guy. But meanwhile, there's a mouthy nerd who's in love with her, played by Keanu Reeves. And secretly at night, she does gymnastics. We don't really know why, what's happening, what's up. But slowly it's revealed that essentially she was a big gymnast. And then her father died in a car accident, which also hurt her leg. And she's been a little afraid to get back on the horse. With the encouragement of her mother, Keanu Reeves, and just pure spite against the snobby bitches on the gymnastics team, she decides to return. Thanks to also the push of her coach, played by Rita Tushingham, who kind of supports her, kind of doesn't support her.
Not so much.
Ends up being in the nationals, I believe, or the regional competition in Niagara Falls, where things come to a head in a insane climax where a million things happen in the last 10 minutes of this film. And then she does some gymnastics. And and throughout it, she's having this... It's interesting because the romance is kind of just the first two acts, and then they're just a solid couple for the rest of the movie. So Keanu's around being charming.
Well, and also her father dying means her mother's remarried a very evil dry cleaner who basically forces this woman who has cancer, it seems like, in a sweatshop, and then kind of beats up his stepdaughter multiple times, including at one of the gymnastics meets.
Yeah.
Like, it's really brutal.
Well, it's interesting because Paul Lynch goes out of his way to say he doesn't write anything. He's like, I am not a writer, I am not an actor. So that's interesting. But I think probably what drew Paul Lynch to this film is Paul Lynch does very, like, blue collar. It's kind of like what he's known for early in his career is these, like, blue collar kind of like salt of the earth people movies. So I feel like the stuff with the abusive stepfather I mean, also, I'm just like, somebody explained to me the story where she was in San Francisco and her mom and her father dies, and then she falls in love with a Buffalo-based mm-hmm. dry cleaner and moves her family mm-hmm. across town. Because in spite of this being Canadian, it's set in Buffalo, yeah. which is a wise Toronto switch.
It's very Toronto. Like, you're on yes. Yonge Street with Sam the Record Man, like the neon signs. It's a really, actually, if you're into Toronto locations in the 80s, this yes. is kind of your film. It's also filmed in Niagara Falls, of course. But and then her yeah. best friends... before she can really, because oh, yes. she's the new kid, is a security guard and his cousin who's the bus driver.
Yes.
And they support her gymnastics dream. The security guard is a security guard for a warehouse, and so he opens the warehouse for her and brings a boombox, and like in a very Footloose situation, like that Kevin Bacon sequence where he's dancing, we get yeah. Olivia Dabo doing that to like this insane security guard dancing to it, like just rocking
smoking
out.
Weed too.
It's really fun. Like, that's the most fun this film has.
That is Dennis Simpson from Polka Dot Door.
Yeah. No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, you didn't know that.
No, it's not.
Yes, yeah. it is.
Polka Dot
dancing into
Simpson.
Your heart.
How did I not notice those moves, those hips? Of course it is. Oh, my God.
That actually was my favorite sequence of that. And I watched it with my partner, Andy, and he was like, why is all that gauze there? And that seems like a fire hazard. But, it is, yeah. but it's fun to yeah. watch. It's obviously not her. We'll get into the controversy of who the double sure. is. Paul Lynch, for people who aren't familiar with his work in Canada, you've probably seen one of his films. Mm-hmm. He's mostly known for genre movies, one of my personal favorite being Prom Night. He also did a wrestling movie that very early in his career that I love called Blood and Guts. That one's wild. But lots and lots of like television, lots of, mm-hmm. You know, you look at like Poltergeist, The Legacy, all that kind of stuff.
He's super versatile. Like,
very much so.
I think he's British born, came to Canada later. Very versatile Canadian director. And so Flying being in his filmography along with Prom Night and Blood and Guts and Humongous is interesting.
Yeah, he's a very interesting guy. He said he was very inspired by Sidney J. Fury, another Canadian kind of worked through Britain.
I see that.
And I guess Sidney J. Fury and Kubrick both started as photojournalists. So he did that. And then I guess you used to do kind of, like, if you think of, you know, old Life magazines and stuff,
yeah.
you would do, like, photo essays.
I know he was a cartoonist for the Toronto Star.
Yeah, for the Toronto Star, too. Yeah. So he has all these weird things, but I guess he got to adapt a photo essay into a CBC TV movie, and that kind of started him on his way. And he interestingly talks about a period that I didn't really know, where I guess there's kind of a sweet spot between the tax shelter and 1986, which really ended in 1984, where there was tax credits, and also the CBC had a lot of flexibility mm-hmm. where he said they funded a lot of independent films. So I think that you see he shifted a lot to television, essentially, was what he said when that dried up.
Yeah. I mean, he's a gentleman in his 70s, if not his early 80s at this point. Like, he's still with us, but he's someone I've always been very curious about because he's a name I'm familiar with, but I've never seen a lot of interviews with him or an actual look at his pretty extensive filmography. And maybe part of that is some of his films. I mean, Hollywood Suite has had Prom Night for years. I mean, we always have kind of Prom Night. We love it. But a lot of his other films are very difficult to track down. Not as difficult as Flying is in a good copy, but like they're just not available.
No, it looks like, according to his IMDb, it looks like he's still working. He has something in pre-production.
Great.
So we are very pro people continuing to
work. And there's a very good, I will say, if you go through his Wikipedia, there's an interview with the blog, which is quite charming. And also he did a great interview in the 80s with Cinema Canada, which you can find the archives at Athabasca University. And they're pretty interesting. He's very frank. I've never read a lot of Cinema Canada, but man, the interviewers are very frank and he's very frank about his career.
I think one of the things we should probably disclaim for this particular episode is both in this case with Flying and the next film we're going to talk about, neither are masterpieces. I think it's pretty rare that we've had an episode where both films are objectively bad films. However, these are fun.
Yes.
Flying is so fun.
It's so fun.
It's worth watching. I'm not going to say it's like, when I was trying to rate it out of 5 on my letterbox, I was like very confused about what to do in this situation.
The qualification of this is one of those party movies, right? Like you toss it on with a bunch of people, you have a few substances, and you just enjoy it, right? Like you're not going to be sobbing into a tissue box at any point. You'll probably be laughing.
Not so many substances that you then would try to like get on a pommel horse or do a springboard. Yeah, I mean,
it should be noted that if you get too intense, there is my favorite part of this film when I knew it would be classic is the flip battle where one of them goes, so I can flip circles around you
anytime, anywhere, right?
They're just flipping in a parking lot. So don't get so high that you and your friends challenge each other to flip down the street.
You're a joke. Everyone on the team knows it. We can flip circles around you anytime, anywhere. You're at nothing.
You're crazy.
Oh, prove it.
Olivia Dabo flips over a Corvette or something like that, like at the end of her like flip sequence to like the whole high school kind of cheering. It's pretty adorable. I really like this film. I actually also would state, and I know I always say it's like I'm a broken record, but I wish I could see this in its proper format, way with proper color. What I watched was basically blood red, a YouTube video. Like to see this on the big screen would be nice and like a proper edition. I would appreciate that. So if you're like a home media person who's got like a small boutique, you know, DVD or Blu-ray operation, I feel like you could get away with doing this for free.
Oh, yes.
find a print, digitize it, figure out where the negative is. Who knows?
So this is, of course, simultaneously trying to use the gymnastics craze of the 80s as well as the flash dance. It's very clear but I believe that like the people who are creating this kind of elevate it to something else that becomes its own little world thing. So we already talked about how Paul Lynch is a genre director. So he actually brings a lot of action, a lot of mood. There's a lot of stuff that kind of
sex.
A lot of sex.
I mean, it's a very sexy movie, it's surprisingly.
Super sexy, it's not
too crude, I would say, too. Like,
it's classy.
I would think that there would be more, like, in locker rooms and stuff if this was a screwball.
No, it's not like a shower scene. It's not like that. It's not. The sex scene that you have between Olivia Dabo and Keanu Reeves is actually really sweet and intimate. Where it gets a little crude for me is, and this is a film that is a montage a minute, basically.
Oh, yeah.
But there's a workout montage in a home gym, and the camera is between Olivia Dabo's legs as she's doing the presses, and it feels so she's like opening her legs wide, closing them, opening. It goes on a little too long. I'm kind of like,
it's
a little exploitation-y.
It's very similar to the workout scene from Flashdance, right? And it feels like they're like soundtrack wise, it sounds like they're also trying to launch like Irene Cara level of stuff. Whereas the music very much sounds like it's out of the Raccoons, which I like a lot because that is.
I love the music.
I do. I don't say that in a bad thing. I think the pop music from the Raccoons was excellent. I'm just trying to make it all Canadian-y.
I mean, for people who might not be in Canada or don't know the Raccoons, Google that theme song, and it is like our national pride.
Yes.
We are referencing a lot of random Canadian.
Sorry, guys, if you're not from Canada.
Thank you so much.
If you're not of a certain age from Canada, even. And I mean, you made a note, Becky, that a lot of this music is from the Lydia Taylor Band. And looking on, number one, look up those songs because they are a delight. And number two, I loved that there's a comment on one of her songs that says, I used to DJ Shakers on Queen Street, which is a strip club.
Shakers,
and Lydia Taylor has a song called Bitch.
Yes, she does, and it's vicious. Like,
that was the number one strip club song in 1989 to 1990. And when you listen to it, you're like, it's like Pour Some Sugar on Me or something. It's great.
Yeah, the soundtrack, and I, you know, it's maybe something that could be licensed now. Like, I want to encourage someone to go back. This happens, right? We encounter films that fall out of copyright all the time because of the music. There is an opportunity to go back, raise the money, license it properly, and then release this. Like, please, someone do it.
And Keanu Reeves is very charming. I think Olivia Dabo is very. I think Paul Lynch is very good at. Like, I actually weirdly think, considering Prom Night is kind of his big film, I think that this is much more accomplished filmmaking than Prom Night. I feel like this is a much tighter movie. He does a wonderful job of visually kind of referencing, you know, Flashdance and all those movies. It's very neon, very fun, weird fashion. The weird, she gets tricked into wearing a costume to a not costume party, and it's the craziest damn costume you've ever seen.
I'm like, what is
I
she?
Tried to convince Brendan Ross of Neon Dreams Cinema Club that this would be a good candidate, although I don't know what version you show because it's
format.
But this is a very fun, like, neo-noirish kind of look that they're going for that they pull off really well.
Oh, yeah. Especially that Footloose doesn't.
Yeah, the sweatshop's crazy.
So dark and creepy.
I know when we were researching this a while ago to be part of the TV show of A Year in Film. And it is slightly referenced in that this is Keanu Reeves's on-screen feature film debut. It's one of four films he did in 1986. Yeah. Everyone talks about Youngblood, but it's actually Flying where he gets this kind of big role. In doing that research like a while ago, I did find something that went through every film location for Flying, and then I cannot find it for the life of me now. And I was like, I knew where the dry cleaners was. I knew where that flip-off thing was. I don't know where all this stuff is, and I want to know. So if listeners know, can they email the podcast and let me know where that all is?
Where did the Mitsubishi Regional Gymnastics Championship happen?
So let's talk about Keanu just for a second, because he is still playing Keanu as Keanu plays Keanu, especially young Keanu. And I've seen a lot of people compare what he's doing to Ducky in Pretty in Pink, which is the same year. But I actually think he's a proto Lloyd Dobler.
Why are you out so late?
Got a detention from Miss Donna Bukowski.
Oh, not again.
Yeah, she said she didn't want me to wear clothes like this in her class. So I took them off.
Oh, you didn't.
Yeah, right down to my underwear. Miss Bukowski turned this really neat shade of purple. It's kind of artistic.
Yeah, I mean, he's got the weird Ducky fashion.
Aesthetic. I want his opening jacket. The jacket that his teacher did not want him to wear. I'm like, I want that thing, and I would wear it
Which
everywhere.
I believe was his jacket. Of course. Those are all his own clothes.
Like, weird Asian lining. I mean, he also has that great, like, tessellated rabbit's shirt, which is very good. But he's, it's weird because he's a bit of, he's like an Anthony Michael Hall almost, where he's cracking a lot of jokes, joking with everybody, really getting on the nerves of the lunch lady. But
and the snobby gymnasts.
Not the snobby gymnasts. And it's interesting because he gets a little burnt by Olivia Dabo, but he kind of waits for her. He knows that she'll eventually come around to his style. And then also I wrote down that he does a Canada only prank where he takes his mini milk carton and puts it on the mean girl's chair and then goes, I thought cats like milk. When she sits on it. To which I'm like, Jesus.
Oh, yeah. I love it. I love it so much.
Oh, what's the matter, Nan? I thought cats like milk.
We talked about genre filmmaking with Paul Lynch. Have a look at John Shepard's IMDb, who wrote this. He has written a ton of MacGyver, so he's used to this kind of, like, here's the, like, lesson of the week, which this very much is. It covers every possible teen issue that you possibly could. But this also led me down a rabbit hole to see that there is a 1994 movie where MacGyver hunts for the lost treasure of Atlantis.
This is
whole new levels of things for me. God, I love IMDb.
Yeah, and it's worth also saying we haven't touched on it yet, but this, due to this weird rights issue and Golden Harvest attempting to release this themselves, even though they weren't distributors, this gets released the same year as another Paul Lynch, John Shepard, Olivia Dabo collaboration called Bullies, which is like a Hicksploitation rape revenge movie, which is more well known, strangely, because it got an actual American release. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know which is, it's just, what do you want? Which do you prefer?
This was at the Cannes Market in 1986. Okay. And according to Paul Lynch, it had like a pretty good reception. Now, I'm not saying when I say Cannes Market, it means there's a market where things are for sale. It's not in competition at Cannes. It wasn't going up against like Denny Arcand and Decline of the American Empire. That would be very unusual. So it was part of the market. And there was multiple offers to buy it for international distribution. And Golden Harvest, I think, made the wrong decision to basically distribute it themselves, which they couldn't do. And so it got no publicity, no marketing, and clearly no copyright or legal love. And that's why we're in this situation. Whereas if it had been, you know, let's say it was bought by Fox, the way the next film, Canadian film produced by CBC, we're going to talk about, was, it would have been released theatrically. And it kind of just didn't. And it's unfortunate.
The surprise for me is I wasn't particularly familiar with Olivia Dabo, but I should be. She should be a star.
Of course,
like,
you should be.
Looking at her IMDb and looking at like all the opportunities she had to be that, and like just seeing what she's capable of. I mean, this is not the role for her physically, as she is a very well-endowed woman and gymnasts tend not to be.
Yes. As a woman with large breasts, I can say that we don't balance well.
No, nor do we swing particularly well. But I mean, she looks great in leotard, so that's helpful. But I'm really surprised that she didn't take off.
I mean, I think she is, to a certain extent, because especially the Wonder Years was very big for her. But I also think, like, I mean, to me, her best role is probably in Kicking and Screaming, the early Noah Baumbach movie. But she was in Conan the Destroyer, which is pretty huge. She
super
was
super young. And Bolero.
Yeah, and she was she's in the remake of La Femme Nikita, which was pretty big. No Point of No Return. So she kind of had that like late 80s, early 90s boom. And now she's actually like pretty huge as a voiceover person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just fascinating career in general.
Mm-hmm.
Totally, totally. And the interesting thing is Paul Lynch also kind of agrees. There's a movie I want to dig up. He did a TV movie called Really Weird Tales with most of the SCTV people.
Oh my.
That apparently Olivia Dabo is in. And he's like, that was my gift to Olivia Dabo was this funny role.
I think she's kind of comparable to Cynthia Dale,
yes,
who we're going to talk about in a minute, where it's like there's a very niche international audience for her that found her highly eroticized. And like, I've met a lot of men who are like in love with Cynthia Dale, and I've always like, American men, I've always found it really interesting. And then I've also met a ton of people who are like, oh my god, Olivia Dabo. And it, yeah, I don't know, she just never took off. I mean, it's almost like she was too erotic.
She's the kind of person where she like, I think she really rises to the occasion of whatever thing she's in, and she just wasn't given enough good opportunities to be good, you know, because when she's in good things, she's great.
I mean, it's interesting because we kind of talked about Jennifer Beals that way in Flashdance. It's not that, I mean, Flashdance was so much bigger as a cultural phenomenon than this film, but I do wonder if something like this got her kind of shittily typecast or just sort of made people not take her seriously.
And this movie treats her a lot better than Flashdance treats
Yes.
Well, this is one of those movies that I am not entirely sure who the original intended audience is, because it feels like it should be a sleepover movie, but then you have that like really tender erotic sex scene and there's a bunch of other stuff kind of going on, and then like you have how brutal all the after school special stuff is, but then like there's the really cool scenes with like all the dancing and things, which are also eroticized, and very clearly he's getting stoned. So it's like, who is this for? Like, what's the intended audience?
Cool teen.
Yeah, it's definitely I could see it looking like it's aimed at prepubescent girls, but it really shouldn't be. Like, although they're probably still
no question like someone rented this for like a bunch of girls to watch at a slumber party, and we're like, and we're turning this.
But that's the glory of the early 1990s and 1980s slumber parties.
Yeah, cable.
We were shown things that our parents did not pay attention to.
Look, she's flipping. Did anyone else cringe when she's doing those flips on the bars and she's smacking her groin on the bar and then flips back up? And I'm like, I don't like it, because they keep zooming in on that part. I don't care for it.
I there was a cringeworthy, and I'm still recommending this film highly, but there's a cringeworthy section for me, which is how this film treats eating disorders in sports. It ain't good, because one friend is basically taking steroids and diet pills. Her dad prescribes them to her so she can lose weight for the competition. She passes out, knocks herself out, gets kicked off the team. And the coach is just screaming at her. Like, no empathy, no compassion whatsoever for this poor girl. She's a teenager. She's a high school student. And then the coach is like, you know, where did you get these pills? And she's like, my dad's a doctor. He gave them to me. Like, that's the kind of pressure they're under. And I just felt that was treated... I'm glad it's in the film, because that's a very accurate depiction of exactly what these girls would be going through. But it's a should have been a little more nuanced, maybe. But it's also
Well, and of course, like, I mean, not only does her father die in a car crash, her mother has this bananas monologue about how she is okay with her husband dying because her daughter will live to see her dreams, which is like, okay, that's wild. But then her mother dies, and then I guess she goes and lives with Keanu, but it seems like it's a short-term arrangement because his parents are out of town, so who knows what's going to happen to her next. She's basically homeless.
She's also living with her friend who... is the rich one I just mentioned that is very wealthy and has this mansion and has an
man, there's just so many weird things about this movie.
It is like every 5 minutes something utterly tragic happens to this character. It's actually kind of unbelievable. Like, that is a little bit of a narrative deficit, I would say, where it's just like at a certain point when her evil stepfather, after her mother has died, shows up at her meet in Niagara Falls to like basically beat her up. I was just like, good god.
I mean, that last 10 minutes is crazy, because number one, you get the monologue about Blondie that is in the last 10 minutes of the film, the inspirational monologue, the drunk stepfather
given by the bus driver
up. The bus driver.
Blondin didn't think about winning, and he wasn't worried about beating anybody. When he was doing all those amazing things, do you know the one thing he was thinking about? Just getting his ass across the falls. That's all. getting his ass across the fall.
And then she does her routine. It's wild. I also like that there's the character of, you know, again, I think the Paul Lynch thing, the weird nuance thing, is there is this abusive stepfather, but the mom seems to genuinely like him. And also, he has a stepdaughter that's, like, slutty but nice to the daughter. Like, the daughter's kind of mean to her, but then she's
not at first, cool. But then she's, like, very supportive.
Yeah, it's kind of like a reverse Cinderella.
Protective of
her. Yeah, gives her the magic leotard that her mother made for her.
Yeah, I couldn't help but think of, you know, that Chemical Brothers music video that Spike Jonze directed? Mm-hmm. I want to say it's, like, 97, 98. And it stars Sofia Coppola, as who was like dating Spike Jonze at the time and before she became a director, as a gymnast. And Sofia Coppola really was a gymnast, tiny little person, makes sense. And I watched that video and I compared it to the last sequence, like the climax of Flying. It's almost shot for shot. And I always thought, I never knew what the referent was. And I wonder if Sofia Coppola knew this film really well as a gymnast. Like, how could you not? Because she has her teammates be really mean to her. Like, her own teammates are basically sabotaging her. And she's got an ankle injury, which I know is also a reference to that famous Olympics that Carrie something or other. Yeah, Carrie Strug. I don't know. I think maybe Spike Jonze and Sofia Coppola were watching Flying in order to do this the Chemical Brothers for, it's called Electro Bank, the music
video.
The
other thing I think is fascinating with this is how low the stakes are in the fact that it's not even like a national competition. It's like a semi-regional.
Mm-hmm. No, it's Buffalo, Fort Erie, and
yeah, it's like it's a semi-regional.
If you
listen,
know this region,
if you're,
Fort Erie's
both
very close.
Of your parents are dead and you maybe don't have anywhere to live anymore.
Take the win.
Yeah, you'll take the Buffalo regional competition gymnastics. You don't get any money.
You don't get any money, yeah, because there's
and the gold isn't even real gold.
Yeah, it's just the dream, right? That's why this the one of these titles is
dream to believe.
Oh,
I don't think you need to think of why that is.
Okay, last question before we go further. Do I eat hot dogs weird at Stan's? Because I don't see any reason why she glares at Keanu Reeves in that moment where he's like doing a normal hot dog and she's like,
I watched it based on your hot dog questions, and I think it's because Keanu is purposefully piling on more and more condiments just to bother her.
Oh,
it's flirting.
Yeah. Is it?
Flirting via hot dog condiments.
Okay.
Yeah, he's goofing off and she's, you know, the beginning where they're courting, she's like not into how goofy he is, and then she kind of gets down to his level and gets super goofy.
Yeah.
And they meet in the middle.
It's worth saying Olivia Dabo, you may also remember as the Lady Garth from Wayne's World 2. So she's
right,
down to
right.
be goofy.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Former guest Emily Gagné. I'm glad she's going to be very happy to use that reference because she's also known as Lady Garth. Yeah.
I think that's where we have to move on to our next movie. So when we come back, it's going to be Ripped Nicolas Cage and a puppy named Rowboat. Is Rowboat a good name for a puppy? Debatable. That's coming up after the break.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The opening scrawl of The Boy in Blue reads, "Before baseball, football, or soccer, one sport alone captured the imaginations of both rich and poor. Sculling. The masses turned out by the thousands to cheer their heroes as they battled on the water, while gamblers won and lost fortunes on their outcome. Having now watched an entire film about one of the world's greatest scullers, Ned Hanlon, I do not think that the scrawl is entirely accurate. Or, if it is, it's simply stating, man, thank God other sports came along. This film, however, is utterly fascinating. It has fresh off Heavenly Bodies topless Cynthia Dale, a mustache twirling Christopher Plummer, and would be totally disposable if it weren't for the glorious slang and the intense and anachronistic Nicolas Cage performance. Alicia, you're such a Cage head. Let's talk the boy in blue and how frickin' ripped he is.
Before we get to that, which I will go into extensively, I do want to mention I did some research on, like, because we're talking about 1880s yeah. sports, mm-hmm. so 19th century sports. And, you know, Ned Hanlon, this is a film about Ned Hanlon, and I'm sorry this is so Toronto-centric, but for people who know Toronto on the island, we have Hanlon's Point. This is partially named for him. I'll go into that in a second. But I want to point out what the top sports were around the 1860s when Ned Hanlon was born. He's born in 1855. Snowshoe racing.
Okay.
Sure.
Boxing was considered too dainty. It wasn't really wow. like a thing. But bare knuckle boxing sure. for prize money was.
I was going to ask what they were doing in snowshoe racing. Were they like allowed to cut each other's hamstrings? It's like that how this
was. Yeah.
It's possible. And then fat man races.
What?
Great. Never heard of it.
Fat man races. Fat man.
I hear you. I hear you. I am processing.
I mean, if Word. Anything, I'm shocked that fat man races has not lasted.
So, I mean, they have if you watched the Spike Network.
Oh,
in yeah. the 90s.
Oh, I need but, a moment.
So when I understand why you're questioning this opening scroll, Becky, but I want to emphasize that truly from my research, which was a CBC article, and then knowing that a very close friend of mine curated an exhibition on 19th century sport in sure. Canada at the Toronto Reference Library, which is how I discovered this film, that truly sculling was the national pastime.
Oh my God.
Like, it was written about in newspapers. It was a big deal. It was the UFC of Canada and the world. And Ned Hanlon, the champion sculler, was truly the Canadian celebrity of the late 19th century. His name was known more than anyone else's around the world, especially in the UK and Europe. So the scroll, to my perspective, is accurate. Now, that is the only thing accurate about
Okay, this great. I was worried about this. I'm like, yeah. I know nothing about Ned Hanlon aside from the fact I've had a good time
Alicia
on his
and
beach.
I can tell you how much of this film is pure lies.
All right. Well, why don't we have a little myth versus fact off whenever you're ready, Alicia.
So Ned Hanlon, it's true that he was a champion sculler. He was also, there's rumors that he was a bootlegger. So the reason Hanlon's Point in Toronto is named Hanlon's Point is actually not because of Ned Hanlon. It's because of his father who had a hotel. And so it was Hanlon's Point. Now, the reason it's still called Hanlon's Point and the reason why there's a topless statue at the ferry dock is because, of course, Ned Hanlon. He used the sliding seat. He pioneered the sliding seat for the first time and popularized it. Before that, the seats didn't slide in rowboats. And so with this kind of engineering feat, he was able to gain a lot of momentum. You see in the film, Boy in Blue, that there is like an old man who designs this seat. And at some point, he looks at Ned Hanlon and he goes, "Slides like butter, boy."
Slides, boy. Slides like butter.
This is the most homoerotic film.
Yeah, I don't think they know, but anyway, the sliding seat kind of puts him, you know, a step ahead. He's called the Boy in Blue because he was kind of known for his blue attire, like baby blue attire. I always thought it was because of his blue eyes, because it's Nicolas Cage, not the case.
Not reading about me back home, are they?
Absolutely. You're front page news. I've even given you a nickname.
Yeah? The Blue Flash?
The Boy in Blue.
That makes me sound like some kind of a fancy boy.
What is most inaccurate about this, I mean, there's just so many inaccuracies. I would say that the biggest one is that Nicolas Cage refused to grow a mustache, and a simple Google search shows that not only yeah. were mustaches absolute musts during this time in the 1880s, 1890s, but Ned Hanlon had the fanciest mustache.
Yes. It seems like he was probably known for his mustache.
He was known for his mustache. He was also a gentleman who was 5'8", which is of course, people were shorter at the turn of the century, but like 5'8's pretty petite and only 150 pounds. Mm-hmm. Nicolas Cage is over 6 feet and the most ripped he's ever been in his life for this film. It
I just rewatched Con Air and he is more ripped in this than he is in Con Air.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. This is like, and they shoot it like I watched Rambo 2 recently, and it's like that. It's like Terminator Rambo rip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, He's 21, so I mean, he's prime. Like, in terms of his...
I mean, he's Nicolas Cage, so presumably he was trying to be a karate star or something.
Well, now, here's my question for you. How historically accurate is the sweatband?
Inaccurate. No sweatbands.
Okay. Just checking.
No sweatbands at all. He is... So every other character, Cynthia Dale's character, who he'll eventually marry, Christopher Plummer, who's this, like, skeezy, rich industrialist who bets on him... They are all in the 1880s. They're sort of speaking like the 1880s. The costumes are pretty good. They're wearing 1880s costumes. Nicolas Cage is in 1986. This is a time-traveling film that just they haven't let us know that. Yes. So they cut out the part in the beginning where Nicolas Cage is Nicolas Cage from 1986, who's then transported to 1885 Toronto to be amongst the other dandies.
Don't do it, Maggie. He's a wet goose. It takes 2 hours to get dressed in the morning. He'd bore you silly. He's going bald, Maggie! He uses Dr. Morse's hair promoter. Bald and boring!
Everything he says, everyone has a Canadian accent in this film except for him. Yeah. Although there is one time where he says A in the tea room scene. But he is not talking with an accent. He is not speaking as though it's 1890s. He is in 1986, and I want to applaud him for this. You can say this is the worst performance, and it definitely is, but there is something here that I'm just like, I guess he knew this was a terrible script, and he was just like, I'm just going to have fun with it. This is the year he did Peggy Sue Got Married, so it's a big year for him. Prior to this, he'd been known for Valley Girl, which we've talked about on season one of the show, and then, of course, he was in his uncle's films Rumblefish and Cotton Club, but hadn't really gotten top billing, but he would this year, and I think it's certainly, this film is outrageous. This isn't mine, but I read one review that was like, this is Rocky meets a Canadian Heritage Minute.
The acting
style is about what you would expect from a Canadian Heritage Minute, which these are not well-known actors that appear in these.
I would like to point out how excited I am at the fact that they try to make it racy and saucy by putting as much 1800s slang as they possibly can. There's a whole lot of buggers and blasts and bastards, and they say them with such venom. Also, I would like us to bring back the filthy urchin as a plot driver.
Mister, I knows where you can get a boat.
Yeah, where?
Cost you a dollar. One of them cigarettes.
I mean, that's that like the I read a contemporaneous review and they go pretty far into just fact checking this film and being like, Christopher Plummer, he plays an evil guy who tries to manipulate Ned Hanlon. It's like that man did not exist. David Naughton from American Werewolf in London is like the Sting style scheming buddy who did not exist. They're like, his wife was named that. But I don't know that there was any sort of drama. Though. Yeah, and even the rum running apparently is like, he did it for his dad's hotel. He wasn't like a fun... and it was like, and I think it was not banned at the time in Canada. It literally was like his dad's hotel didn't have a liquor license, so he just needed to secretly get liquor.
And I think also he was rowing probably to Rochester across the water, across Lake Ontario. I don't know. I don't know my facts. I'm probably saying something wrong too, but he might have been getting booze from the US, which would have been better quality booze. Who knows? But to come back to Cynthia Dale's character and what you're talking about, Becky, with like, all the 19th century slang. At one point, so they have sex. She's engaged with someone else. They have sex. She says something like, oh, I can't believe you compromised me. And then goes, compromise me again.
Yeah. this is again when we're talking about whether or not flying isn't much of a like a horny exploitation movie. The fact that Cynthia Dale has a topless scene in this stupid movie is more exploitive than anything else. And I mean, it's super horny for Nick Cage. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, he looks amazing. And like I
don't know about that haircut.
Before COVID,
his body looks amazing.
Pre-COVID days, so this was my first canceled screening of the COVID era, was Boy in Blue. We were going to do the first theatrical screening of Boy in Blue in Toronto for Uncaged. And so I was like super ready. I gave an interview about this film to Now Magazine that never got published. Like I was in it to win it. And in cutting the trailer for Uncaged, like that trailer was hinged on just all of the insane montage shots of Nicolas Cage, so sweaty, working out, looking gorgeous. Like, please, listeners, just Google Boy in Blue. Look at the poster. look at what they knew they had to market this film, because this is a CBC produced film that somehow got theatrical distribution through Fox in the US, and is mind blowing to me. And it's Charles Jarrett, this British director who is known for like Anne of a Thousand Days with Genevieve Bujold and Richard Burton, was known for Mary, Queen of Scots with Vanessa Redgrave, had been not nominated himself for Oscars, but had directed actors who were then nominated for those performances. And then this is what he does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it seems like just about everybody, with the exception, Christopher Plummer, we will talk about this later. Christopher Plummer phones in nothing. Yeah. I don't think there is a performance in his career he has ever phoned in. Cynthia Dale, same thing, shows up. Mm-hmm. I would say just about all the actors.
I think Cynthia Dale
suffers
a lot from the whiplash of her scenes being with a guy who's not acting like he's in olden days at all.
But I just want to point people towards this incredible Los Angeles Times article from 1986 where he is just about to blow up. This is the greatest introduction to any like puff piece about an actor I think I've ever heard.
I think I know what you're going to talk about. It involves one of his pets.
Nicolas Cage wanted to introduce his pet baby octopus to his visitors. Putting his hand into the aquarium, he dislodged the creature from behind a rock. Angry, it squirted ink over his fingers and shot away into another hiding place. "He's mad at me now," said Cage. "What a pity. Just when we were beginning to get along." This man is a maniac. Like, this is just
wild.
He has
a lot of eccentric pet stuff. Like, there was definitely an iguana that he was constantly bringing onto set. I can't remember which film it was. But then this is also the LA Times article that is the first mention of Lewis, his cat that he did mushrooms with.
Oh, good Lord. Well, this is like the article is interesting because it talks about Peggy Sue Got Married is just about to come out. And Boy in Blue had just come out. And he just writes Boy in Blue off like immediately. But he's like, Peggy Sue is going to be great. Yeah. I'm really excited about Peggy Sue. So,
well, the interesting thing, too, is it's not, I think, because it's not commented on much contemporaneously, but a few times when they were making the movie before people knew that it was not a good movie, people were kind of butthurt that this American guy was playing. Mm-hmm. Ned Hanlon, but yeah, once it came out, the like, again, back in Canadian cinema, there's like a review that essentially says that this is just like a mashup of like Rocky and Chariots of Fire and weirdly The Sting thrown in.
Yeah. I think what's kind of fascinating to me about this film is that because the story of Ned Hanlon is actually kind of boring, they, of course, do their best to throw in every possible thing that could make this difficult, right? So that everybody is sabotaging each other. There's a bunch of stuff in slow motion. There's something happening at one point with an oar, which I am unable to see, even though they keep like zooming in on it.
It's also incredibly poorly shot. I really want to say. And I thought I was crazy. Like, I think it looks beautiful, but for how you would have to shoot sculling, they do not do that. You have to understand it, you have to shoot it from the side,
yes,
because you're seeing the end of the boat and when it goes through, and they shoot it almost all in close-up. Also, I'm like fascinated that when you read about Ned Hanlon, the thing he really, like, even beyond the sliding seat, he was the person that like popularized the sliding seat, but he had a stroke that was unique to his competitors. And they don't go into that at all, nor bother explaining it. So it's like, that is the one thing that you could say is he had it. But you're right, Becky, like, essentially there's this great review by J. Paul Constable is like, they make all these cliches, like they try to make it more dramatic but just add cliche after cliche and it's pointless. And he also has a very fascinating take where he says that like they rely very heavily on American sports movies cliches and essentially Canada is not interested in that. He says like the great Canadian sports movies are like the Terry Fox Story, which is quite dark, and he essentially says that what Canada wants isn't Rocky, they want Raging Bull.
Yes. You are correct.
Like, what they do here is to, like, Canada doesn't want an inspirational sports movie.
If I had to picture what happened here, and this comes back to a point that you made, Becky, for flying, I think the CBC had a butt ton of money. And this, you know, we're kind of out of the tax shelter years, obviously. That's pretty much over by 1983. But I think CBC had money, and there's probably government money based on a certain subject of filmmaking that had to be, like, you know, Canadian heroes or something like that. And they're like, oh, who do we? And it was like, okay, Ned Hanlon. Like, it feels like such a flippant decision. And then they're like, well, Fox is willing to like put up some money if we get a big name. And they're like, well, we can't afford a big name, but there's Francis Ford Coppola's nephew. So like, let's fly him up. And then, I can't imagine. Yeah. Like,
well, it's kind of even a conspiracy at the time. But this, so you might have noticed that at the end of the movie, it's dedicated to the memory of a lot of people.
And I one didn't of the people, notice that. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So it says it's dedicated to a couple people's memory. And one of the people's memories who it's dedicated to is Canadian director John Trent, who died in a car accident. And he was apparently prepping this Ned Hanlon film. And he died very suddenly in this car accident with his son, who was a sportsman himself. But he did like Death Dream and stuff. He's kind of like related to a lot of producing and directing in the early 80s. So anyway, I will say, like, contemporaneous reviews tend to cite that this was supposed to be John Trent's movie and isn't. And what is on screen is likely a pale imitation of what John Trent would have planned.
Okay.
That makes sense. This is all coming together, like the puzzle pieces are, you know, because there's not a ton on this film written. Like, there's a ton on Nicolas Cage films. There's people who have whole podcasts dedicated to watching every Nicolas Cage one by one. And this one always gets left off. I find it very rare that people have seen Boy in Blue, even though it's actually on Blu-ray and we have it on Hollywood Suite.
Yeah.
And I want to recommend people to watch this on Hollywood
Suite. Honestly, I mean, I think it's worth a watch.
Just to see a Canadian sports history, even this point in Canadian history, short of Anne of Green Gables, is not
19th century.
A lot.
Yeah.
Honestly, there were moments where I was having a lot of fun watching just how intense Nicolas Cage is, because this is pretty, like, intense Nicolas Cage. Like, he doesn't phone this film in, even though for some reason he decided not to grow a mustache. He is a man who acts with his facial hair, so I am unclear why he was not okay with that, and I feel cheated.
I think that there comes and goes eras of mustaches being considered a little gay, and I wonder if that's... because everyone else in this film has a mustache except Nicolas Cage.
An impressive mustache. Maybe if they'd given a role to his pet octopus, he would have agreed. There's water. There's a lot of water. There's a lot of wistful boat looking. And I feel like there's plenty of drinking games to be had here. Anytime someone looks wistfully at a boat, you take a shot. Anytime someone has weird sex wearing a pinafore, you take a shot. I think that's the way to go.
I loved, Cam, I know when you watch a film on your Instagram, you always kind of post, you log it and say that, you know, like a one-sentence review. And when you did this the other night, someone, I don't know who, was like, my dad was a stable boy in that film. Yeah. And my boyfriend was like, everyone's dad was a stable boy in that.
I think I replied, a whole lot of stables in this movie. So it'll be hard for me to narrow down your dad.
So funny. Yeah. My dad was a stable boy in Boy in Blue. And then I know someone who is very close to Hollywood Suite on our board, a very influential person in the film industry, was a location scout on this film in the beginning of his career.
It seemed like this show really employed a lot of people. So I will give it that. Like, there's a huge cast.
I mean, it's probably a hell
extras.
Of an undertaking to shoot boats.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, even the background performers. There are so many background performers in this. Like, I will give it that, like, although it looks like a movie coming out of the 80s Canada in the way we think of Canadian films, which is inaccurate, it definitely looks like there was money spent. Like, at no point does it feel like someone was just like, let's just throw two sticks together and see what happens. We'll make a movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that.
And if it wasn't for Heritage Minutes, I don't think it would have that corny Canada feel either.
Yeah.
Like, other than, like, people are playing Canadian, so you can't really fault them on accents and old-timiness. But I think, the problem is, I actually looked to see if it was the same cinematographer on Heritage Minutes, because I'm like, why does this feel so much like a Heritage Minute? But, yeah.
There is a Ned Hanlon Heritage Minute officially, right?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I tried to look it up. There's at least a sculling one about the Canadian sculling.
I don't know if there isn't... How is there not one on Ned?
I mean, all you need to know about Ned, my favorite Ned Hanlon fact is there is a Toronto, New South Wales, because Ned Hanlon was so popular in Australia because he came a lot to do sculling competitions.
That's insane. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Huh.
Named in honor of a local hero, Ned Hanlon.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Hanlon's Beach is the clothing optional beach.
That
on
is
Toronto
correct.
Island? Oh, yes. That's a nice legacy. Yeah.
I actually would like some sort of clothing optional thing named for me, possibly a tea party.
I mean, considering Nicolas Cage is basically clothing optional throughout this entire film, and keep in mind this is an era where women didn't show their ankles, and he's just topless the entire film.
In front of her.
He does it to shock people.
Yes.
He loves being
At
topless.
One point he goes to beat up a Harvard man, and he like rips off his ratty sweater, and he's like, get up, Harvard man! And he starts like
You know, that was a very good Nicolas Cage. Get up, Harvard man.
Can you play that soundbite?
Of course I
it
can.
It might have been a Yale man. I'm not sure.
I think it's Yale. I think he's pissed about Yale. He seems like Yale is funner to yell than Harvard is.
Get up, Harvard man!
Just have to watch it again, guys.
Well, when COVID, you know, when the theaters open up, presumably the first screening I'm doing because I've already booked it. So.
Well, you've created quite the thirst trap. Everybody's ready. Everybody's thirsty. So yeah, we'll go from there.
Yeah. A lot of people had questions because the trailer was, you know, all pretty lesser known Nicolas Cage ones. But this one, they were like, what is that film?
I think that's probably the best place to leave it, as it is always, thinking of Nicolas Cage as a thirst trap and not as an utter maniac as we know him today. Allegedly, I'm not going to get sued over that. Cameron Maitland, thank you once again.
Thanks, Becky. I don't know. Very inspirational episode.
Lots of Canadian stuff. Cam and I are Canadian film, I wouldn't say aficionados, but like we have seen many. Yeah. I've seen over 300 of them. And you know what? These are a lot of fun. And it's I think it's a good starting point for people to be like, go watch some Canadian film. It's good for you. It's good for you. Good for your country. Be a patriot. Alicia Fletcher, my binational friend. All right. Thank you so much once again.
Thank you. I would like to state that I have a very different opinion of Nicolas Cage than you do. Just to set the record straight.
Totally.
I don't believe he's a maniac.
Really?
I mean, maybe he is. I don't know.
Just a little. Minor. Eccentric? Because he has money? Eccentric?
Oh, he's eccentric.
Okay.
Sure.
Great. But as long as we're both
there. I understand. There's a method to his madness, and I even see the method in this insane film.
I think that is the perfect place to leave it. All right. Join us again next week where we look at two movies that could be considered the new American Gothic, and both of them star Dennis Hopper on a comeback hot streak. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial free. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. Supervising producer is Ryan Maines. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagné. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.